We're talking about trauma tonight, and two of our guests are psychiatrists. Richard Molica runs a refugee trauma center at Harvard. He teaches at the Harvard Medical School. Stuart Lustig has worked a great deal with the Sudanese refugees, the last boys of Sudan. He, too, is an MD psychiatrist and teaches at Boston University Medical School. Selma Ferhat-Begovic spent her teenage years, her high school years, a lot of the time in a tunnel in Sarajevo that was safe from snipers. And she's going to talk about her own experience. She's a recent graduate of Northeastern University, and she's going to talk, among other things, about how refugees recover. But we're applying, in a certain way, modern medical science to the mystery of the children of Heracles who do not speak in this play. Richard Molica, I wish you'd start just talking a little bit about invisible wounds and make those wounds visible and maybe even treatable. Okay.
In the play, the children do not speak, the refugee children, and this has been the phenomena since the beginning. You almost never hear the voices of the refugee experience by refugee children, by refugees themselves. Two small examples. When my colleague Jim and I first visited the High Commissioner for Refugees in Geneva in the late 1980s to discuss the mental health impact of mass violence, we were thrown out of the High Commissioner's office because he said, refugees do not have psychological problems. Another example is when we were working in the Thai refugee camps where 50% of the camp were young children, children under the age of 16, 17, very small children. There was not a single agency that gave voice to the experience of these thousands, tens of thousands of small children running around. And our group finally one day, we just sat the children down and we began to speak to them because we couldn't take it anymore. We said, you know, we're surrounded by kids just running around this camp and we have absolutely no idea what their experience is. If you look at our oral history project here in the lobby, that was our attempt in the early 1980s for the first time to hear the voice of refugee women from Cambodia who had recently arrived to the United States who are not patients. These were not patients. And it, Swang and I, my colleague, we've been working, listening to these women now for 15 years.
Can I be very blunt about it? I mean, psychiatrists have a hard enough time getting people to stop smoking when they desperately want to. What can modern psychiatry do for severely traumatized refugees? What are you offering?
Well, you know, the problem in psychiatry has been in medicine. Let's look at medicine in general, is that up until 20 years ago, there was a cynicism and also an antagonism towards survivors of mass violence, particularly Holocaust survivors. And the belief was that if someone had been through an experience of mass violence, they couldn't be cured. In other words, the psychological wounds of mass violence and torture were incurable, and that these were also problem patients because they couldn't be cured. Over the past 20 years, this has completely changed. We know, for instance, that 90% of people who've been through extreme life situations do not go on to develop serious mental health problems, 90%. And with the 10% that do, they usually develop a well-known problem. They develop chronic depression, hopelessness, and despair over a lifetime that ultimately can lead to early death from cardiovascular disease, diabetes, etc. So, and we have wonderful treatments today. We have excellent treatments today for this kind of situation. So people do not have to live a lifetime of chronic hopelessness and
treatment
despair.
Meaning talk, meaning pharmacology, or what?
Well, in our group, I mean, we use the whole range of treatments. I mean, we, for instance, the most important thing for us is to, first of all, look at the resources. In other words, every individual has a tremendous capacity for resiliency. Through the humiliation of violence, that's been damaged, and through the killing of family members, etc. So in a way, the clinician becomes, we used to say, we become the family doctor of the community. You begin by becoming the family doctor of the community, and as part of that family, that larger, whether you're in the Cambodian community, Vietnamese community, etc., you begin to see how you can help build the resiliency of people. And this can, for the sickest people, I mean, what people don't understand is that for the very, very, very sickest people, psychopharmacology, counseling, very intensive, being with a person is very therapeutic. But people quickly leave that state. And also, most people, the psychiatry we're talking about is the psychiatry of the general population. I don't know if you can understand it. It's the psychiatry of normal people who have been through terrible life situations. It's not the psychiatry of the seriously mentally ill. And it took me almost 20 years to understand this. We're talking about the psychiatry of general normal population, not the psychiatry of the seriously mentally ill. I think my colleagues here would agree.
Stuart Lustig, tell us about your experience with the Sudanese specifically.
Chris, as you know, I work with a group of Sudanese boys called the so-called the Lost Boys of Sudan. And these are a very compelling group of now young men, actually, who have been fleeing the civil war in southern Sudan, which has been fighting with the north of Sudan for the past 19 years. And let me tell you what I think works in terms of treating people who've been through some really horrific experiences, be they refugees or, as Rich was saying, other people who may not be refugees. When something terrible happens to you, it's really essentially a crisis in meaning. You have to figure out, you know, where do you go from here? Most of us, I think, go through life, especially if we've been fortunate in our upbringings, thinking the world is a good place, people are basically decent, things happen for a reason, and so forth. And then all of a sudden, something really catastrophic happens. I think where psychiatrists and other therapists can help people is to figure out, well, why did this happen, and what can I gain from it, if that's possible? How do I move on? How can I use this experience for some positive outcome at this point?
What does storytelling have to do with it?
Well, storytelling, I think, basically lets people take a look at their experiences in a different light. For people who don't talk about their experiences, and you know, many people from all over the world don't have an interest in talking with psychiatrists, that they come from places where there aren't psychiatrists and where it's just not something that's done. So what stories do is let you step back from your own relationship with what's happened to you. It takes you out of the role of victim or sufferer and enables you to use those stories in some way to understand things differently, to educate others potentially about what's happened in other parts of the world, to advocate for better conditions, and transforms the person then from one of survivor or from sufferer to not only survivor but educator, advocate.
When you talk about the sort of context of meaning, and then when you talk about testimony, I immediately think of things I'm learning in this process night after night. I'm thinking of a young Somalian woman at the age of 7 in a Kenyan camp, now on her way to being a carpenter in this country, and a spectacular young woman. Mm-hmm. But she talks about, and from a distinctly Muslim and her own mother's example, she talks about taking care of her inner self, mm-hmm. and constructing her own meaning and her own health in a certain fashion. Mm-hmm. When you speak about testimonies, I'm thinking about another man who's been here twice, Ibrahima, who said to me the last time we walked off stage, you know, this is helping me, mm-hmm. just to tell my story to an audience night after night. Mm-hmm. Well, what can we learn from those two in particular?
Well, I think in the case of Ibrahima, what's especially important is the fact that everybody is here listening. I think, you know, it's less likely that he may want to come and talk to me in my office, for example. There may be less hope that something good could come of that, even though traditional psychiatry, I think, would say just getting the trauma story out and the process of kind of going over it with another person who's listening supportively is helpful. But I think the reason having several hundred people here listening is because then he is becoming that person who is now a spokesperson for the country he's coming from and educating everybody about the experiences he's had there. And that's what's useful about testimonials, I think.
Selma, I wish you'd talk about your own experience and especially your observation of people who get it together again and go on. How do you do it?
Well, I think it's very hard to talk about these experiences. I don't think that when I first came here that I would look for a psychiatrist to talk to him, especially for the reason that it's hard to explain to someone who hasn't been through what you've been, to tell them everything. Oh, here's where I come from, this is what happened, and this is how I feel now. And you always think, is this really going to help, telling this to a stranger? It's much easier to talk to a friend, to someone who knows you, who, better yet, someone who has experienced something similar, or, you know, who has been where you have been. I think that's the most difficult thing, people coming out. I don't know if you guys have actually encountered those problems, people coming out to you and talking to you. When I first came to U.S., I wasn't really talking much about Bosnia or talking much what happened there. Or I just came here and I wanted to fit in. I didn't want people pointing at me and saying, oh, well, she came from Bosnia, although that's the first thing people ask me when they hear my accent. Where are you from? From Bosnia. And, you know, their eyes open wide and they ask, really? So how was it? What did you go through? And it's hard to, every time you meet someone first, to go explaining to them or telling them the first bad thing of your life. I think that's the most difficult thing to deal with.
So first you avoid it.
Well, yeah, it's kind of, not that you avoid it, but you don't want that to be the first thing of people knowing about you. You don't want them to say, oh, that's a girl from Bosnia, you know? You want them to know you as a person, as what you are, or what you accomplished here, what you became. Yeah, we lived through this horrible thing. It happened to us. You know, none of us wanted it, but we lived through it, and some of us made it here, and we came here, and we're doing so well now. And, you know, you want that to be known first.
To follow up on what you're saying, I think a lot of people, though, do avoid it when they first come for a variety of reasons. You know, one is I think they'd like to put the traumatic past behind them and move forward and look to the new country, and there's a great deal of hope and optimism, I think, when people first arrive in a new country. So part of it is just moving on. There's also a cultural piece, too, I think. Depending on where people come, it dictates how they feel about talking about painful experiences. If you're coming from the Buddhist religion, for example, you probably feel that if you're suffering, it's part of your karma, and you know you don't kind of continue to try to work through it, as we would say in kind of psychiatric jargon, you just accept it. In other societies, certain African societies, for example, if something bad happens to you at the hands of another person, interpersonal violence, for example, that requires a political solution, not a psychological solution, and anger is a more appropriate, as it were, emotion than, say, sorrow or fear. So people, I think, don't talk about things for different reasons when they first come here, which makes our job harder.
Yeah. I'd like to problematize this a little bit. The problem of the doctor in listening to the traumatic life experience of the other is the doctor has not had that experience. And so there's a big problem in psychiatry. You understand what I'm saying. The Bosnians, for instance, when we've worked in Bosnia for 7 years, Bosnians are in-your-face people, basically say, we don't want to hear your nonsense. You know, we don't want to hear your interpretation or our life experiences. So you have a big problem in terms of forming a partnership as an outsider to a culture and to experience. You can't come in as a dominator. You can't come in with some kind of cultural hegemony, some kind of paternalism. That is very difficult for doctors to listen to someone from another culture who's had a traumatic life experience and really listen and not come in with all their baggage about this is post-traumatic stress disorder, this is, you know, the death instinct, death imagery. You know, I mean, we have so much baggage that we bring to listening to the trauma story. And it took me a long, long time to really build confidence in myself that a patient would actually want to talk to me, because I don't know their culture. I don't know their language. I haven't witnessed 60 members of my family being killed, etc. The fantastic part of this whole thing is that people really appreciate not only a good listener, but someone who wants to be a good partner in a solution. You know, in other words, the Bosnians talk about this, you could talk, extraterritorial space that, you know, I once joked with them. I said, you mean extraterrestrial space? I mean, are you looking for someone from outer space or are you looking for someone from extraterritorial space? And I said, we need the outsider to give us some perspective, just like the arts give us perspective. We need the outsider to give us some perspective on our experience.
Selma, do you know what you're talking about?
Yeah, because what's
the word?
Well, he said it right. It's extraterrestrial. It's weird because we kind of were lost when it all happened. You know, none of us really expected it. I mean, I was 14 years old. I didn't know that my best friends were Serbs. So when something happens and all of a sudden you're in this field of confusion and you have no idea what is going on, you kind of need someone to come from somewhere out there and just tell you, well, tell me what you think it happened and let me see if I can figure it out from outside, you know, how is it really working out? But it's very, at least to Bosnians, I think it's very important that you have this personal relationship with them. I think for us, it really matters that, you know, it's much easier to take advice from your grandma or from your best friend than going to a stranger into his medical office. And I don't know if we have this weird thing towards psychiatrists or, but I think that could be I can see that being a problem for people coming with traumas, you know, how would they address this problem? And I always remember, you know, a lot of people ask us, like, how did you go through all this and everything? And I always think this one thing that my dad said in the middle of the war, we didn't have electricity or anything. We were sitting around the table just talking. And, you know, my mom looked at him and said, well, how are we going to go through this? What is going on, you know? And he just said, well, we're just going to take it easy. We're going to try to survive and not go crazy. And that one thing, not going crazy, always stayed in my head.
To follow up on Stuart, what you're saying about, you know, who you talk to, and do you talk to friends, or do you talk to a psychiatrist or a psychologist, you know, as much as I think we as psychiatrists would like to think that, you know, all that book learning and analytic training and medications that we learn about are helpful, and I think truly they are, I think, you know, the biggest reason that people get better in the context of a relationship with a therapist is by virtue of that relationship itself. And if you look at all the things that you know, that we use as tools, kind of the number one predictor of whether people get better is, in fact, how good a relationship do we have one-on-one. So the hard part, I think, working with the kids who I work with from Sudan is getting them in the door. But then once they're there, you know, then we can get down to kind of what you look for probably from your friends or family members when you talk with them.
Can I mention another great Greek playwright, Sophocles? Is that allowed to?
Arrival, go ahead.
In the Sophocles play, his last play, Philoctetus, there's a wonderful line, because Philoctetus was the great friend of Hercules, and he was mortally injured because he had the bow that would bring the end to the Trojan War. And as the line from Philoctetus, I didn't know I came from Philoctetus, was, Philoctetus says, I am a stranger in a strange land, you know. And that beautiful line, what it's all about really is that when any of us in this room, any of us can pass over to the other side, any of us can be a victim, become a refugee, be a victim of mass violence, etc. When you pass over that line, over to the other side, you become a stranger in a strange land, and the rules of life change dramatically. You don't live in the same with the same rules, right? You don't live.
Yeah.
The game is different. The rules are different. Let me give you, if I just wanted to read this beautiful quote from one of our oral historians. I mean, this is the kind of, this is a Cambodian woman in our oral history who was an uneducated woman, a rice farmer, who never wanted to be a victim of mass violence. I mean, no one wants to be a victim of mass violence. But when they pass over the line, they can't go back. In other words, once you've gone over the line, you have a new life. And this is her, one of the beautiful insights she gave to Swang Tor, myself, my colleague who worked in this oral history. She said, she was talking about the death of her children and her family and how she dealt with this. As a mother, she said, This way, I think that those who died escape the sorrow temporarily. Those who are alive always have sorrows. The old folks would come to me and tell me that my children had no father and that I should not make them orphans again by not having a mother. I was reasoning about this for a long time, and I felt better. But in the back of my mind, I still had some sorrows. Not all of the sorrows were gone. I thought about my children, about their future. And this part blows me away. You know, she says, they were born, her children, she says, they were born, they saw the sunlight, we would not abandon them. We would not abandon them. The father had died, so the mother should remain. That's the kind of insights that people have on the other side.
Selma, I'd like to know what happens sort of after the avoidance process. Then what? And I'm particularly interested in how people deal with anger. I'm reminded, actually, of a trip to South Africa. We went to Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela was imprisoned for 20 years. And one of the men who, in the next cell, came with us, a man of remarkable serenity and peace. There was a Romanian refugee on the trip, and she took him aside on the boat back from Robben Island. She said, how do you deal with your anger? She said, it's 30 years and more since I left Romania, and I'm still furious. And you have dealt with it somehow. And he had, and obviously Nelson Mandela has too. How do we account for different ways people manage, and how do we deal with questions of revenge and the fury that still lives in a lot of people, including in this play?
Well, as far as revenge goes, first, that I think that's a big problem in Bosnia because it's a small place and people know each other. And if you lose someone, you know who killed that dear person to you. You know the person who shot them. You know the person who killed them. So it's hard not to think when you see that person, well, I want to do something to them. But what I think it's important is that people realize that if you keep on doing that, it's never going to stop. You know, and I think Bosnian people try to think in that way. Well, you know, we had enough of sorrows. Let's stop it now. And that's why the war stopped, because that's why it's not going on anymore, because people were just, in a certain way, fed up with it, you know? They didn't care anymore. You're going to split the country? Split the country. We're not going to have what we used to have? Fine, we're not going to have it. Let's just stop this nonsense, you know? It's hard to deal with it. It's hard to live through it. And they just wanted to put a stop to it. And I think once you start thinking that way, that regardless how much maybe you would want to revenge the person you lost, you have to stop thinking about it, because you're going to get into this circle of revenging everybody, you know, who was ever killed. And you have to start thinking that everything bad that happened made you think or made you become the person you are afterwards, you know? And that should be a reason that you should fight for some better things, that you should try to accomplish and make it better, you know, if not for yourself and for your children. Or
this is an argument in the play, and it's not quite clear that that sentiment prevails. Dr. Lustig?
Yeah, I would follow up on that, though, and say I think the notion of making things better is a way to channel your anger into something useful. The country you mentioned, South Africa, one of the things that comes to our minds when we hear South Africa is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was a very public way of creating a process by which to document all of the atrocities under the apartheid regime. And there were a lot of problems inherent with that process that weren't particularly protective of people who came forward with their stories. Well, one of the things that I'm interested in as a psychiatrist is about the safety and well-being of people whose stories are used for bettering the world. But channeling that anger is one way to kind of get past what you're angry about. Because for some people, it's going to be hard to forgive. And so what do you do instead?
Well, Richard Malika, seriously, what does psychiatry know about revenge?
Well, what I was going to say is that underneath revenge is humiliation, deep humiliation. And the goal, from my experience and our group's experience, the goal of mass violence is to humiliate. To humiliate the individual, the family, the society, the nation. It's a deep humiliation. People cannot, the biggest problem with humiliation is that in psychiatry, for instance, we don't have a single article by, a reference by Freud or any of the great thinkers about humiliation. Humiliation really hasn't really played much of a role in psychiatry today, you know, up to this point. But there's a problem with humiliation is that our societies socially reinforce, encourage, I'll see what you think about this, you know, reinforce and encourage the two basic responses to humiliation. One response is hopelessness and despair on one pole. The other response is revenge, hatred and revenge. Sometimes in a suicidal person, a suicidal killer, you know, the suicidal terrorist, it can be both together, hopelessness, despair, and hatred. And the problem is that if you look at societies and you say, what does society tell us about the middle ground, doing and finding another way through, you know, hopelessness and despair, revenge and hatred, I can't find it, right? I mean, do you find it
it's
in Bosnia?
It's a difficult thing to deal with, and, you know, and people who are really, who are full of hatred and are eager to revenge, there's no explaining to them, there's no logic. You can't tell them, you know, you cannot be mad at this person who killed your brother. It doesn't work that way, and you can, it's hard to relate to it too, right? So it's just, like you said, you know, trying to force yourself to think, well, it happened, but do I want to be a person as bad as that other one who killed my brother was? Like, you know, let's try to make myself a better person, use this, what I've lived through, to make it better.
This is a serious issue, too, for a lot of the child refugees that we take care of, many of whom who've been exposed to various war atrocities have also been pulled in as child soldiers against their will and are being forced to fight, and this can have a profound effect on their moral development when what they see is an environment in which looting, killing, raping are the norm. And the longer a child stays in that environment, the harder it is for them to regain the kind of morality that we would consider normal and healthy.
Richard, I think you've told us something important about humiliation. I mean, even more than guilt, even more than suffering, the experience of humiliation is a kind of bomb under the culture. I don't know what more you want to say about
well,
it.
Well, there are many, I mean, people, I think that society, there's a social fiction that develops. We saw this in New York. Our group went down to Bellevue right after September 11th to help our colleagues there. We saw this in Kobe, Japan after the earthquake. A social fiction develops very quickly. It goes like this. My life is great. I didn't live through Kobe. I didn't live through New York. I'm doing fine. And the people in New York, they got to solve their own problems. In other words, the fiction is created at a public level that you don't need collective healing to have individual healing. We have that social fiction going on in the United States today. We don't need to heal ourselves as a nation from the deep humiliation to have individuals in New York or the Pentagon or whatever heal themselves. This is a fiction. It's not true. You need both. You know, you isolated individuals in New York cannot heal themselves unless there's a collective healing, right? I mean, this is the big problem in Bosnia now. And so there's also a political manipulation of humiliation. I mean, we see this in our state, for instance, where we've allowed the Cambodian community in Lowell, Massachusetts, to go without mental health services for 20 years because depression in victims of mass violence from Cambodia is normal. What's the big deal? You know, why do these people need mental health services? You understand what I'm saying? This is accepted at a political level. Or on the other hand, we got to get the bastards and kill them, you know, to make up for the injuries. You see this in Bosnia, right? I mean, you know, we have to hurt those who have hurt ourselves, you know. It's playing out constantly. Humiliation is playing out constantly. And the last point I was going to make is that the biggest problem with humiliation as well is that it's very hard for us, if you look at the humiliator, all perpetrators of humiliation do humiliation under a utopian banner. They do it under utopian dream. Greatest Serbia, you know, ethnic cleansing, you know, it's all purification, you know. In other words, if...
Forgive me, but I can't help thinking about Imperial USNA, too, as one of the great humiliators, and looking for opportunities, even as we speak, to put people in their place.
You know, after September 11th, we had a saying, you know, there are no small people, there are no small actions. People asked us, what do we do with September 11th? I said, one thing you need to do is reduce your own aggression. This is Primo Levi's point, you know. The Holocaust, his experience of the Holocaust is about daily life. What did he learn about daily, everyday life, you know? We have to reduce our own aggression and guard against humiliating others as a response to humiliation. That's right, that's the vicious cycle. You know, I agree with you. I mean, in other words, the response to humiliation, whether it's on a cultural level, individual, family level, is not to go out and humiliate others. This should be the discourse right now. It should be a dialogue of reconciliation, not more, you know, more hatred, more anger, more killing, you know, more war. This is completely in the wrong direction.
Let's talk about it. I would like to welcome any questions, answers, testimonies, objections from the audience. It's harder for me to see you than for you to see us, but if you've got a thought, the microphone will come to you. Here's one right here at the back of the front section, and the microphone is on its way. Wave your arm, and the microphone will be there.
Hi. I was thinking about the question Richard Mollica was posing to us about whether there's a middle ground between the hopelessness and the revenge. And then I was thinking of Selma's response to Richard, which was, I guess, her family's decision and her own decision and her own realization that people would have some kind of future thinking. And that if one can have the capacity to be a future thinker or a forward thinker, then that can put you into the logic mode and protect you from your emotions, of these powerful emotions and actually necessary emotions of revenge and hopelessness.
Richard?
I agree. I mean, that's a great point. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I appreciate your comment. We're all struggling with this. I mean, I think, you know, anyone who gives a simplistic answer to this is not telling the truth. Someone murdered your entire family, and you're going to develop neighborliness after being repatriated as a refugee. It's crazy, you know. But on the other hand, if that's not solved, 20 years down the road, this comes out in the play, right? You have to kill the children because the children will come back to kill you, right? I mean, it just, blood demands blood, you know. What do you think? I mean, what do you think? What's the answer to such powerful, primitive situations, you know? Blood demands blood. What do you think? I mean, you want to say something? Yeah.
The microphone is passed.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, it's been passed. But anyway, this is a great, great problem, you know.
In the play, they referred to not as children at one point, but as snarling cubs. And, of course, wouldn't you get, having disposed of the lion, wouldn't you get rid of the snarling cubs, too? A thought.
Well, an unconnected thought to that, but... I'm wondering also if survivors themselves are able to help other survivors. I did some volunteer work with the Marjorie Kovler Center for Survivors of Torture in Chicago, and one of the things, if for better or worse, there were becoming different generations of Bosnians, and so sometimes somebody would be trained and then be able to work with somebody else who was coming from that different situation. I know this is against what you were saying about extraterritoriality, but I'm wondering if there are also lessons or support that survivors, via their own experience, can help with each other in ways that outsiders might not be able to.
Selma.
I think it's a good question, and it does help. Most of the Bosnians here tend to, well, we don't really have extremely strong community, but we do have groups of Bosnians that, you know, hang around together, and I think that was the biggest support to me. I came here and I had two cousins, and it was very good to have them here, to have them tell me, you know, what to expect here or how to deal with the emotions of, like, emptiness or being so far away. You know, you come here and you think, well, what am I doing here? It's great, you know, everything looks beautiful, but how am I going to handle this? What am I going to do with it? And having someone who went through what you went through and is also here helps a lot, lets you accept the situation that you've been put in, or, you know, try to grasp the best of it, or try to really handle it really well. Like, for me, that was really big help. But, I mean, of course, later on, it helped me a lot to be around, especially at my university, it helped me to be around Americans. Because if you want to fit in your new culture and your new life, and if you want to get a better perspective, you can't get it if you're only with the people who went through terrible experiences as you did. It helps to get this new, fresh perspective and this other understanding, I think.
Can I follow up on that, too, actually? I think there's a well-known organization actually worldwide at this point that involves people helping other people who've been through similar problems, and it's called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that definitely if you've been through something, or you're from a place where others have been, where you've experienced the same kinds of difficulties, you know, certainly you're in a position to help. I think there's a certain amount of intellectual honesty that's required, and that we have to go through as therapists as well. And the question really is, I think, you know, can I take someone down a path that I've not walked down myself? And there are two ways of thinking about that. The flip side being that if you're so far down that path yourself and you've suffered exactly what the other person has suffered, are you able to take a few steps back on that path in order to be objective and helpful to the person? But I think there is definitely potential to be so.
Please.
Yes, very briefly. Doesn't it help, talking about the space between revenge and forward thinking, and the fact that this is possible in South Africa and to an extent in Bosnia, doesn't it help a great deal that Nelson Mandela and his party came to power and were in a position to forgive from strength, that in Bosnia the Hague trials have to be therapeutic in terms of making forgiveness possible? Whereas in some place like the Sudan, where the people who are refugees and are being oppressed remain weak, the answer may be military training and arms in terms of what the outside world can provide. And point of information, Stranger in a Strange Land is from the King James translation of the Book of Exodus. Moses says it.
Thank you for the last. I was trying to remember whether it wasn't Jacob who was the stranger in a strange land. Was it not? It's a great line in any event.
But the point, how can I say this around, that there is a will at the political level, just as there is, Herman Bach said, there is a will not to believe that human beings do terrible things to other human beings. I mean, this is clear to me, you know. But I think at the political level, what you're hitting on is there is a will also not to be just. once you believe that something and you admit that something's happened, like in Guatemala or all these wherever, there is many, many reasons why it doesn't pay to be just. Being just at a political level takes great leadership, like a Nelson Mandela, etc. And so you have many phony experiments all over the world around justice related to peace, you know, in post-conflict societies. And this is also very anti-therapeutic, because if you have, you know, the international community saying we're working on justice here in Guatemala, but the government really isn't behind that, you know, it's a terrible message to the people who've been through mass violence, you know, terrible experience for them. And it's this is a common experience right now.
Can I follow
Please
up?
Please speak to the point about Mandela coming to power and the Sudanese victims not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in the case of South Africa, certainly Mandela as a role model for showing us how to forgive is helpful. But the problem on the ground, though, is something like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission there, is that you have people who are not able to tell what they wanted to tell. There's an elaborate application process that you have to go through to be allowed to contribute. And then you certainly don't get a copy of what you stated. So people who come forward with their stories are quite disenfranchised, I think, in large part, from the whole political process, you know, regardless of how behind it the government was. You know, in Sudan, I think, you know, the problem was, in some senses, you have to, for the kids who I've worked with, you have to leave the country in order to, you know, kind of make your story known. And this is a country, as, you know, some of you may know, where 2 million people have died over the last 19 years. 4.5 million have been displaced but are still in the Sudan, which is the largest displaced population of any country in the world. And there are anywhere from 10 to 15,000 slaves at any one time as well. So that leaves a very disempowered group of people right there who are able to become part of the forgiveness or reconciliation process.
Question.
This is a belated response to the what do you think? I wasn't thinking at the moment. From Richard Malika. You were asking about, you've got to kill the children to get rid of this problem because they'll be resentful, so we have to kill them so that they won't retaliate. That just reminded me of an organization in the Paradox of Israel, what continues to go on forever in Israel, is an organization of parents of dead children, something like that. And as you mentioned before, AA, it's a similar, they have something in common. The Jews and the Palestinians in this organization have lost their children, and they've gathered together for peace to think in the way that Selma was talking about, this, what I call the future, forward thinking. So I don't know whether anyone here knows about that organization, but I was so impressed by a letter that I saw that the head of the organization wrote. I think it was shown in The Nation, but that's it.
Well, we know a little bit about it now. Thank you. Thank you. Please.
I'm sorry, I don't remember the woman's name.
Selma?
Selma. Gosh, I guess of everybody on stage, you're the one person I feel that I have a visceral connection with in light of what I came here for, and I can't help but think what was your experience, and of the last 45 minutes that you've shared so little, gosh, I have so many questions and so many. What is your experience? I mean, you're the person here who's actually, and maybe it's by design that you haven't addressed that, but.
I can meet you for a coffee later. We can sit and talk. No, I mean, there's just, it's a good question. Thank you so much for asking. But it's hard to pick what to say, you know, and what is a good thing that people can relate to, or what is a good story to tell and people will understand and take home and say, wow, you know, that really made me change my opinion about refugees, or made me think about refugees in a certain light. And I just think it's very important for everybody to understand that these people are coming, they don't want any pity, and they're not sad, and they're not horrible people. And what happened to them, they didn't think it was going to happen to them, you know? They just lived a normal life, and it happened, and they had to leave their homes, and they came here to try to start their life again or make something out of it. And for me, that's an important thing. I would love if everybody here could think that way, you know, when they leave here tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please.
Try to be brief here. I'm struck by the enormity of the situation. And I'm thinking about African Americans who are refugees living here in this country. Brought here, captured and brought here. Can't go back to Africa. And may I say, for many, not really welcome here, not at home here. And in the founding of this country, it was plainly said, you know, we're not fully human. So what I want to deal with is, it's remarkable that the situation of the African American, which is kind of, it's in the paradigm, it's present. It's like the elephant being in the room and nobody noticing the elephant there. So we have on a microcosmic level the problem daily. And I think this thing going on here, if I may say so, is great. And it's most important that we bring into this the condition of African Americans who are refugees in a land where they're not really welcome, not all of them. So I just want to lay that out. And by the way, compliment you on the enormity of this event. I think it's great. So that's my little contribution to this great event.
Thank you. Selma, I just like wanted to ask you one last thought. And picking up on what you said in response to the last, you have a word, and I want you to remind us of it, among Bosnians, that deals with letting go of suffering. And it seems to me, especially after 9/11, we need it. New York needs it almost more than we do. But to avoid this wallowing and the cult of victimhood and to see our pain in a larger perspective. 3,000 people died at the World Trade Center. Since that date, something like 25,000 people have died of landmines in the world. And it's not to compare them or trivialize either one, but to how do we get to see our own suffering in some perspective and then get on with it? And what is the word?
Richard actually reminded me of it before. The word is merhamet, and a lot of Bosnians here there would be able to associate with it. We say that we're merhametli, which means, you know, just be good and try to think good of other people. Just let it go and think what you can do good to help someone else, regardless of what happened to you, you know? You have to make it better.